advice that he consulted him before deciding to run for mayor of New York. Quote, I think he had the brightest political mind in the country, unquote, Rudy said of our mutual friend. I remember that one of Jay's dying wishes was to dance at Rudy's wedding. He never got that chance. Only Rudy was more broken-hearted than Jay. I wish the people of Iowa knew where Rudy was on Tuesday. Obviously, I wrote this column about Rudy at a time when I held him in the highest regard. I was proud as an American of his leadership in New York City on 9/11 and thereafter, and we were both grieving the loss of a close mutual friend. Rudy was compassionate and very loyal to that friend until the tragic end. Back in 2008, I thought Rudy was presidential timber. But today, those sentiments are gone. There have been several statements and incidents associated with him in the last few years that have caused me disappointment, but the one that represented a real tipping point came on February 18 of 2015. That night, Rudy stopped by a presidential campaign event for Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker at Manhattan's 21 Club that was attended by 60 conservative Republicans and members of the media. From published accounts of the event, it's not at all clear to me that he was a scheduled speaker or that his remarks were planned. Nevertheless, Politico reported the following, quote, I do not believe, and I know this is a horrible thing to say, but I do not believe that the president loves America, Giuliani said during the dinner at the 21 Club, a former Prohibition-era speakeasy in Midtown Manhattan. Quote, he doesn't love you, and he doesn't love me. He wasn't brought up the way you were brought up, and I was brought up through love of this country, unquote. I found what Rudy said appalling. The epitome of the never-ending vicious campaign against President Obama intended to cast him as an other, not one of us, but a representative of some sinister force brought here like the Manchurian candidate. In a word, I thought it was the statement of someone who was unhinged. Remarks like those have made me realize how much Rudy not only misses Jay's friendship, but also his guidance. I don't think Jay, as much as he loved Rudy, would have had much tolerance for the way in which he questioned the patriotism of an American president. Specter practices and endorses civility. Philadelphia Inquirer, December 16, 2007. I have watched Arlen Specter, now Pennsylvania's longest-serving U.S. senator, deliver countless speeches, but never had I seen him talk quite as he did when he addressed 1,000 people on December 8. The setting was the Grand Ballroom of New York's Waldorf Astoria Hotel, site of the Pennsylvania Society's 109th annual dinner. That is the centerpiece of a weekend during which the Keystone State's political movers and shakers gather in pomp and collegiality. That night, Specter was the 99th recipient of the Society's Gold Medal for Distinguished Achievement, awarded every year since 1908 to a figure of unfailing leadership and wide-ranging contributions. Former awardees include Presidents Dwight Eisenhower and George H.W. Bush, sports figures Arnold Palmer and Joe Paterno, and media figures Bill Cosby and Chris Matthews. He began his remarks, as he so often does, by taking off his wristwatch, placing it on the lectern, and telling the crowd he wished to, quote, give you a false sense of security that I am paying attention to the time, unquote. He continued by showing some of the humor that recently earned him second place in an annual Washington Celebrity Comedy Contest, complete with references to Bob Dole and Viagra. Having watched his performance on YouTube, I was disappointed he didn't reprise one particular one-liner on Dan Quayle, quote, he thought harass was two words, unquote. But then he reached inside his tuxedo pocket and withdrew a few index cards. I knew immediately he had something important to say and that he wanted to get it just right because Specter rarely, if ever, speaks from notes. Despite dining with my friend Jack Daniels, I'm glad I had the presence of mind to jot down a few of my own. This was Specter as Pennsylvania elder statesman, anxious to deliver a message about the need for civility and compromise, not shrillness and contempt. He spoke like an ideological moderate, fed up with the left-right extremism too often seen on the split screens of America today. And he thought the future should have more of the camaraderie so evident in New York City that night. Quote, "The importance of courtesy and civility is critical at all levels, international negotiations, national, state, and local government. This weekend is exactly the kind of time when we should all reflect on how much we have in common and how much harder we should try to get along," unquote. And then came this key line, quote, "If you can lift a glass together with your colleague from across the aisle on a Saturday night here in New York, you can lift your pen with that same colleague across the hall on Monday morning in Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, or any place in our state," unquote. His introduction had been accompanied by a video presentation that rolled through the stages of his career, from hard-charging district attorney to Warren Commission staffer to unsuccessful gubernatorial candidate. Included in the high-tech scrapbook were images of Specter on the world stage with Fidel Castro and Yasser Arafat, which prompted a round of guffaws from the audience. It occurred to me that his office had no doubt supplied those images to underscore his point that we live in times requiring more, not less, dialogue. That became evident when he praised President Bush for writing a letter to Kim Jong-il that began, quote-unquote, "Dear Mr. Chairman," calling that greeting of respect a good move as we strive for better relations with North Korea. He cited President Ronald Reagan's successful arms reduction treaties with the USSR, even after Reagan had tagged that country the evil empire. And he credited diplomacy for the deflation of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's terrorist tendencies. Sitting on the dais through all of this was Governor Rendell, himself an actor in Specter's sketch of cooperation. Specter shared a story from his final days as district attorney in Philadelphia. Riding in an elevator in City Hall, a young Ed Rendell told his boss he planned to make a career in public service. Specter offered to introduce the young prosecutor to city Republican leader Billy Meehan, at which point Rendell informed Specter that he was a Democrat. Before that, Specter said, quote, "I did not know, or for that matter, care about his political registration," unquote. He also shared a story in which Chief Justice Earl Warren shook the hand of Jack Ruby, already convicted for the murder of Lee Harvey Oswald. Later, in connection with the work of the Warren Commission, Warren lent Ruby his eyeglasses. The goal in all these anecdotes, he told me a few days after his speech, was to inspire those in attendance to transport the nonpartisanship evident in the barrooms of New York to the courtrooms, war rooms, and chambers of Pennsylvania. Tweaking a Barry Goldwater line, Specter told the crowd, quote, "Moderation in the pursuit of virtue is no vice, and that is the approach which must be extended to our county courthouses, to Harrisburg, to Washington, and beyond to international conferences. This is the approach that will ensure that when you future gold medalists stand in my place on a future second Saturday in December, you can declare, as I do, that we still live in the greatest country in the history of the world," unquote. I miss Senator Specter, who passed in the fall of 2012, immensely. He was an intellectual giant with ethics beyond reproach and a work ethic second to none. Frankly, he earned a better exit from electoral politics than he was afforded. In 2010, having changed parties, he lost a Senate primary to Admiral Joe Sestak, who in turn lost in the general election to now Senator Pat Toomey. Specter's change in party was precipitated by his 2009 vote for the stimulus package, which he regarded as the most consequential vote he ever cast. In his book, Life Among the Cannibals, he wrote, quote, "As proof mounts that the stimulus saved the country from a depression, that vote, which cost me so dearly, should count as the most important of my 10,000 Senate votes. Hard to compare with trebling NIH funding, but in the same league," unquote. Our final meeting was over martinis and dinner at a Steven Starr restaurant in Philadelphia called Barclay Prime, a conversation that stands out because I was encouraging him to take his vast knowledge of the Kennedy assassination out on the road the following year, marking the 50th anniversary of that event, and he gave me the unsolicited advice of running for his seat in the 2016 election. Neither of those things came to pass. I was honored to be one of his pallbearers. Mr. Chrome Dome gets fuzzy. Philadelphia Daily News, January 10, 2008. It sprouted on Christmas Day, though not because I had planned it that way or intended it at all. That's just the way it began. Christmas is obviously an atypical day. My wife and I sleep only until the first of the kids awakens, and from the moment one of them comes into our bedroom, nothing that follows mirrors the usual daily routine or even that of a weekend. Instead of heading for the shower, we all go downstairs for coffee and gift opening. That process is a lot like Thanksgiving. It takes my wife 4 hours to cook a meal that we eat in about 4 minutes, including the moment that it takes to say grace. The time it takes to open packages feels like the same 4 minutes. When the gift giving had ended this year, I decided to stay in a sweatshirt and unshaven. The day after Christmas, I got into the shower but didn't draw a razor, not for any particular reason, and again, without a plan. I just didn't feel the need. By day three, I needed to leave the house, and at that point, my joyride became a plotted course. I decided to grow a beard, at least until I had to return to work. Well, it's been 2 weeks, I'm back at work, and the beard is staying, at least until my wife acknowledges I have one. So far, she's said nothing. I've been bald since college, so hair decisions have been few. 5 years ago, I shaved my head, and it was one of the better things I've ever done. I only wish I'd done it sooner. That decision was born of an unusual circumstance. I'd taken my wife to the old Guardhouse Inn in Gladwin for dinner in honor of her birthday. Albert Brewers, the chef owner, gave me some homemade schnapps as an after-dinner drink, and when we left his place, my wife, who was also the designated driver, noticed that her hairdresser, Maurice, was still open for business across the street. She said she needed to make an appointment. So we walked in together and Maurice took a look at me and suggested I come for an appointment too, which is when the schnapps kicked in. I said okay. The following Saturday, I got my hair done. In a salon full of mainline women, I sat while Maurice gave me a military-style buzz cut. Then the women voted, unanimously, that he keep going. When it was over, my head was totally shaved, and I became the only man to ever pay $125 for that honor. My wife explained that Maurice had a reputation that commanded such prices. I wasn't sure how I felt about the new me when I left. 2 weeks later, I found myself in Cuba having dinner with Senator Arlen Specter and Fidel Castro. I think my new look was why Fidel took me for a military CIA Bay of Pigs organizer. Nonetheless, all I needed was a little sun on my noggin, and once I had that, there was no looking back. Since then, guys contemplating the full Monty of haircuts often seek my advice, which is fourfold. One, buy an anti-steam mirror. Two, use the mirror to shave in the shower. Three, use a multi-blade handheld razor. And four, find the right lather. I recommend Hillan Naturals Vetiver and Rum Sapone de Barbara. I get it online from an old school apothecary in Chicago. So as 2008 begins, I'm now sporting a Seamus McCaffrey up top and a Jerry Garcia down below. Actually, it has yet to grow to that level, so I have no idea if it will. So far, it's salt and pepper in color, so I guess that's politically correct. I still have some decisions to make, such as to length. I intend to trim it somewhere between a Pat Croce goatee and a ZZ Top Rip Van Winkle look, and I'm unsure of how high it should grow up toward my ear. I've yet to decide if it will still be around when the fills hit Clearwater. That will probably be determined by if and when my wife acknowledges it. You'll know it's staying when you see my column photo change. Happy New Year. As you might know from seeing me on television, I still sport a beard and shaved head and still get asked by listeners and viewers for my advice on grooming both. For me, one of the great guy treats in life is to get a head shave and beard trim from a professional and the best I've found are at George F. Trumper Gentlemen Barbers and Perfumers in London, which first opened in 1875. I don't visit England without making a stop. Go to the original location on Curzon Street in Mayfair. As described on its website, Trumpers.com, quote, Trumper's original Curzon Street shop remains the same with its beautiful mahogany-paneled private cubicles and stunning displays of grooming requisites, unquote. Famous clientele past and present include many British royals. Trumper's has received 5 royal warrants over the years, Winston Churchill and JFK. Obama sees route to righteousness. Philadelphia Inquirer, March 23, 2008. On Tuesday, this son of Eastern European stock drove into Center City to bear witness to a speech about race delivered by a candidate who described himself in his remarks as, quote, the son of a black man from Kenya and a white woman from Kansas, unquote. Representative Patrick Murphy, Democrat of Pennsylvania, the product of Irish and Italian ancestry, had invited me as his guest to hear Senator Barack Obama. He also offered the possibility for me to conduct an interview with Obama for use on radio. That chance prompted my producer, a Mayflower-bred, Harvard-educated, mainline mom, to offer to carry the sound equipment and drive us to the event in, what else, her Volvo. Immediately after the speech, lunchtime added to the bustle of the block at 8th and Race, where I stood with my bald white head and my BlackBerry. Meanwhile, my lily-white colleague sought to retrieve her cross-country wagon. Unfortunately, in her haste to exit the parking lot, she scraped an immaculate SUV in the adjacent space. Her defense, she herself was on the phone, responding to a request from Fox News for me to react to the speech. When I went to inspect the damage on the other vehicle, I took note of the Puerto Rican flag hanging from the rearview mirror. A parking attendant responded to the fender bender. He was a black man wearing a bow tie and speaking with an African accent. I heard him tell my waspy producer she couldn't leave the lot until his manager arrived. While she was handling this development, I saw a Latino man with close-cropped hair and low-hanging jeans cross the lot, and upon seeing the damage to his 2007 Suzuki, he was instantly anguished. Manny, as we later learned he was named, was understandably upset to learn what had happened in his absence. An hour earlier, I'd been watching Barack Obama. Now I was caught up in an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm with more metaphors than I could keep track of. I'd walked into the National Constitution Center thinking like Howard Baker. What did Barack Obama hear from the Reverend Jeremiah A. Wright, Jr., and when did he hear it? I wanted to know what kept him coming back to the pew after 2 decades of toxic diatribes, and I wondered whether he was really taken aback at seeing the now notorious YouTube clip of Wright, whether he'd been present for that sermon or not. After all, he had disinvited Wright from delivering the invocation at his campaign announcement for some reason. I exited the speech thinking that if I ultimately do not vote for Obama, it will be for reasons other than his minister. What I found most refreshing about the speech was Obama's willingness to give it all, a totally unmuzzled talk about race. He spoke with customary elegance in stark contrast to the angry rants of his pastor. How ironic that this powerful orator has been undermined not by his own words, but by those of his pastor and some of his critics. He has managed to distance himself from the angry extremists to his left and right, using something more than just grandiose language. Substance. The transcript is definitely recommended reading. His speech noted the reality of America's history of racial inequality, but also the legitimacy of some concerns of the white middle class. And he made admissions. Quote, did I know him to be an occasionally fierce critic of American domestic and foreign policy? Of course. Did I ever hear him make remarks that could be considered controversial while I sat in church? Yes. Did I strongly disagree with many of his political views? Absolutely. Unquote. Perhaps most important, Obama made clear where he believed Wright had been wrong. Quote, the profound mistake of Reverend Wright's sermons is not that he spoke about racism in our society. It's that he spoke as if our society was static, as if no progress has been made. A country that has made it possible for one of his own members to run for the highest office in the land and build a coalition of white and black, Latino and Asian, rich and poor, young and old, is still irrevocably bound to a tragic past. But what we know, what we have seen, is that America can change. That is the true genius of this nation. What we have already achieved gives us hope, the audacity to hope, for what we can and must achieve tomorrow, unquote. A point well taken. How can America be so fundamentally unfair and racist if one of Wright's very congregants is now positioned to capture the Democratic nomination for president? As Obama said, quote, "I will never forget that in no other country on earth is my story even possible," unquote. Two blocks away after the speech, the lot attendant with the African accent returned to tell the WASP woman and the Puerto Rican man not to worry because his manager was en route. And sure enough, within a few minutes, a natty BMW pulled up and out popped Mr. Tran, the Asian supervisor who had come to sort out the unfolding drama. All parties spoke civilly, cooperated, and parted company with handshakes all around, which reminded me of something else I'd heard that day. Quote, "We may not look the same, and we may not have come from the same place, but we all want to move in the same direction, towards a better future for our children and our grandchildren," unquote. After this ran in the Sunday Inquirer, I posted it at HuffingtonPost.com, where, unlike my newspaper columns, I get to write the headline. I used "Curb Your Enthusiasm Meets Barack Obama," which I like more than "Obama Sees Route to Righteousness." I just think it better captures the scene I experienced. I could see Larry David and Jeff Garlin caught up in a moment like my producer TC's fender bender with half the UN involved. The speech was one of the pivotal moments of Senator Obama's primary campaign against Senator Clinton. Had it been poorly delivered or received, I think it would have been a negative turning point of the campaign. Instead, the content and delivery kept him forward moving. I wrote in the column that Congressman Murphy invited me because he was trying to facilitate an interview for me with the senator. It did not come to pass that day, but it did soon thereafter when we had a memorable Good Friday conversation that I wrote about in my book Morning Drive. I have since returned to the relatively small auditorium at the National Constitution Center where this speech was delivered, including hosting Libertarians Gary Johnson and Bill Weld there in 2016. And whenever I'm there, I find myself looking around, remembering the Obama speech on race, and thinking that I witnessed history being made here. How I Got the Bird, Philadelphia Daily News, April 3rd, 2008. Another South Philly guy is in the news for getting jammed up. And while everybody else is wondering what one Doherty's guilty plea means to another Doherty, I'm thinking about the eagle on my desk. Until the end of last week, I hadn't kept close track of the criminal case against Donald Gus Doherty. Like everybody else, I've now read that he's pleading guilty to 98 of 100 counts of theft and tax offenses, just not the two that allege illegal payments to John J. Doherty. I know both Dohertys, although one far better than the other. I've known Johnny Doc for years. I think I met Gus Doherty only once, but it's a day I won't soon forget. That's when he gave me the eagle. Mike Baldini introduced us. Baldini is another Philly guy, Father Judge, LaSalle University, but not one in any trouble with the feds. He's a Runyon-esque fellow in his early 40s who used to run sales for my radio station and now does the same at KYW. He was born in South Philly, grew up in the Great Northeast, and is raising his family in a Montgomery County town with Ville at the end of it. I have a hard time picturing him in the burbs. Baldini is fun to watch, fast-talking, mind-always racing, constantly sizing up people that he meets with an innate sense of street smarts. He's perfectly suited for his sales manager job. He's a people person. In a previous life, I could see him working as a maitre d' at one of the big casino showrooms, making sure that Sinatra had enough Jack in his dressing room while simultaneously deciding who sits where out front. One day a few years ago, Baldini said he needed me for a sales call in South Philly with an electrical contractor named Doherty. I told him I already knew Johnny Doc. Baldini said this was another South Philly guy named Doherty who also knew a thing or two about fuses. I said I'd go if he took me to lunch at Shank's. He agreed. Gus Doherty's office was special. It was one of those environments where the women were especially pleasant, called you hun, and wanted to know if they could get you a cup. Upstairs, Gus had a plush suite with sports memorabilia, a big fish tank, and a comfortable leather sofa, which is where he held court and where I first spied the eagle. It's a gold likeness, about a foot high with its wings fully extended, sitting on a plain wooden base. It's not real gold, and it isn't a trophy awarded for a particular event or exploit, but to see it is to know that it has a history. I told Gus I thought it was beautiful. He immediately told me he wanted me to have it. I told him I couldn't. Then he said it used to belong to Leonard Toews, referring to the former owner of a team full of eagles. I've had a soft spot for Toews since I was a kid and spotted him riding his bike and wearing a green velour tracksuit on the Atlantic City boardwalk. We chatted that morning and he was awfully nice to me, a young boy. His aide-de-camp, Jimmy Murray, has since told me endless stories of Toews' kindness and charity. I'll bet Toews would have liked Gus, but I don't think they ever met. I asked Gus how he got Toews' eagle. He said that Toews lived his final days at the Warwick Hotel on 17th Street, and that Toews had given it to the hotel doorman as a sign of appreciation. The doorman gave it to Gus for reasons that were unclear, or I have since forgotten. Now Gus wanted to give it to me. I hemmed and hawed, then finally accepted. I rationalized my acceptance by thinking that Toews would like knowing that the newest keeper of the eagle appreciated his contribution to the city and was once thrilled to meet him down the shore. It was a gracious gift from a guy who's now jammed up. Gus could do time, which is sad. And me? I'm recording the provenance of the eagle while sitting on my desk and wondering who'll get it when I'm gone. I hope it's someone who appreciates what a small town this is, and maybe it will end up on Senator Doherty's desk in Harrisburg. In August of 2010, a Philadelphia developer named Steve Salms died, and I wrote about him for the Sunday Inquirer. Salms was the driving force behind Historic Landmarks for Living, which changed for the better the complexion of city real estate. He converted countless factories and industrial spaces into luxury apartments. As I noted at the time, quote, I only knew him peripherally, but I always got a kick out of his joie de vivre, unquote. He was, for me, the epitome of a Philly guy, a character. Steve was feast or famine, or both. I remembered seeing him in the midst of a real estate crash, looking no worse for the wear, sitting poolside at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas with a wad of cash buying a drink. I then reflected on the number of characters I've been privileged to know having spent my entire life in Philadelphia. And believe me, as I use the term, character is a compliment. I only named a few that I'd crossed paths with or had come to know. Charlie Bowser, Hardy Williams, Jim Beasley, Jay Waldman, Thatcher Longstreth, Russell Byers, Ed Rendell, Pat Croce, and Zach Stahlberg. I concluded with this, quote, I don't know what it's like to live in Phoenix or Dallas, Indianapolis or St. Paul, but I have a hard time believing they can match us man for man. Hopefully it stays that way, unquote. Well, Leonard Toews should have made that column. The generous, dapper, NFL owner and four-time husband who violated the cardinal rule of the casinos, bet with your head, not over it, was such an interesting guy. Like those I reference in the column, Mr.'s John Doherty, Gus Doherty, and Mike Baldini. Toews was pure Philly. So too his alter ego, Jimmy Murray, who was the Eagles' general manager under Toews during my childhood. One of the highlights of my youth was rooting for Toews' Eagles, despite many losing seasons in the 1970s, especially when Roman Gabriel was briefly their quarterback. The team fortunes and that of the city changed when Toews hired Dick Vermeil, who took us to the 1980 Super Bowl. Sadly, Toews never got to raise the Lombardi Trophy. Toza's life deserves the full movie treatment. For now, we have to settle for a short but fabulous piece directed by another Philly guy, Mike Tolan, which is an ESPN 30 for 30 feature called Toes, the Movie. The Bird on My Mantle is a tribute to Leonard Toes and all Philly characters. Russert Brand Discourse versus Cable Carnival Shoutfest. Philadelphia Inquirer, June 18, 2008. A few weeks before the Pennsylvania primary, I received an email from an associate producer for a national cable television program who wanted me to appear on a show about Barack Obama. Her email said, quote, "We're looking for someone who will say, yes, he's cocky, and his cockiness will hurt him. If not in the primary, definitely in the general election against McCain," unquote. I passed. She responded by asking if I would instead say Hillary Clinton was untrustworthy. I said no. A few days later came another invite. Quote, "We wanted a person to go after Hillary and how often she lies and how it's easy for her, etc." Unquote. Although I again said no thanks, I am sure in each instance someone filled the prescribed role. I was thinking about those exchanges while watching the many tributes to Tim Russert, whose memorial service was scheduled for today. How ironic that the same journalism community that faded Tim Russert after his death Friday has so many members who don't follow his lead. Russert never practiced the brand of journalism upon which many radio and television careers today are predicated. It seems almost hypocritical that he should be extolled by those who don't emulate his example. Tim Russert didn't become the preeminent political journalist in the nation by browbeating, condescension, or debate stifling. He was a facilitator of intelligent political conversation, not an enabler of the stark left-right, black-white, Democrat-Republican, liberal-conservative cable world in which we now live. That doesn't mean Russert asked guests to check their partisanship at the door or that he was devoid of strong views. To the contrary, his was a forum where clear difference would emerge, but minus the edge that has otherwise become commonplace. Through direct discourse, not shouting and crosstalk, he guaranteed that all sides would be represented, and not in a carnival atmosphere. Russert was forceful, yet deferential. He'd ask the tough questions and then afford an opportunity for a response. Perhaps reflective of his law school training, you could always count on him to bring up the prior inconsistencies of a guest's various statements. But unlike so many of his would-be successors, he'd always follow up with a willingness to listen to an explanation or reflection. Russert combined an intellectual understanding of the intricacies of government and policy with street smarts about the electoral process, honed no doubt from his days of service to both New York Governor Mario Cuomo and Empire State Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. That combination of comportment, political acumen, and wit made Russert a unique bridge, someone to be relied upon for guidance about matters of great importance, and yet you wished you could seek that wisdom over a beer or two. I interviewed Russert twice after each of his books, Big Russ and Me and Wisdom of Our Fathers, were published. He was as impressive on the receiving end of questions as when he was the questioner. Perhaps his greatest gift was his humble, down-to-earth nature, which he likely gleaned from his father. When we last spoke almost a year ago, Russert told me he admired, quote, the quiet eloquence, unquote, of his father's hard work. Well, like father, like son. Not long after I interviewed Russert about Big Russ and Me, I selected it to be read by a small, informal book club to which I belong. Eight guys who get together every few months. We read, yes, but more important, we drink, eat, and enjoy one another's company. I had asked Russert if he would mind telephoning our gathering and chatting with the group for a few minutes. The host of the most esteemed talk show in America obliged. That night, in a small private dining room at a George Perrier restaurant on the main line, his call arrived. He was on a cell phone in his car, and we lost the connection soon after it began. But the guys were thrilled, and Russert seemed to get a kick out of their interest in his book. Months later, I met him at an NBC party in the Rainbow Room, high atop Rockefeller Center, where we spoke for a few minutes. I was eager to talk politics. He wanted to know more about my book club. I painted the picture of our end of the call, especially the camaraderie he'd inspired. Tim Russert seemed to genuinely enjoy the fact that for one night, he'd been a catalyst of such friendship. Eight years after his passing, Russert's words still mattered. In a sophisticated conference room high atop the Time Warner Center in Midtown Manhattan, CNN Worldwide President Jeff Zucker shared with network talent the statistics for 2016, which was CNN's most watched year ever among total viewers. CNN ranked number one in all of TV, cable, and broadcast on election night in prime time among both total viewers and the coveted demographic of adults aged 25 to 54. But when, after celebrating the past, it was time to look forward and talk about CNN's relationship with the incoming Trump administration, Zucker put on the video monitor the words of his former NBC colleague, Tim Russert. Quote, "The primary responsibility of the media is accountability of government, whether it's about lying under oath, which upset Democrats, or the mismanagement of responding to a hurricane, which happens to upset Republicans." Unquote. Requiem for an Era, Philadelphia Daily News, August 21, 2008. It's Monday night, and I've just joined the end of a long line waiting to enter a viewing in South Philadelphia. The obituary in the Daily News said it began at 6. When I arrived at 7, the line was already wrapped two blocks down Reed Street. I've been up since 3 a.m. and hosted two radio shows, but I don't regret the wait. It's not often that you see an outpouring like this, especially when half the town is down the shore. It's a good thing for the several hundred of us snaking down the South Philly sidewalks that this August night isn't a particularly humid one, but it is a uniquely Philly scene. There's an old-time feel. The BlackBerry I'm tapping as I record these thoughts doesn't quite fit in, even though the crowd is fairly young. Every age group is represented, but most look to be in their 40s and 50s. Lots of closely cropped hair, guys in suits, sport coats, or open dress shirts, women wearing what women wear when guys dress like that. Several hold mass cards. There are plenty of appointed and elected officials. Many more are on public payrolls. I stand for a while in front of a row house with a Flyers banner hanging in the window alongside a sign saying, "Parking for Italians only. All others will be towed." Next door, an older woman in shorts, white sneakers, and white socks sits on an immaculate stoop. There's a pot filled with colorful artificial flowers and an American flag. I'm thinking she cast a couple of votes for Frank Rizzo. Cars are double parked everywhere, but something tells me that'd be the case even without the funeral. I'm sure it's somber inside the Rogers funeral home, but out here people are friendly and chatty. They know each other or know somebody who knows somebody. Lots of "how you doing" and "what have you been up to?" It's a glimpse of the way the city used to look 30 years ago, very white and ethnic. And in fact, I'm thinking that many of these people won't have far to travel to get back home, even if their kids are headed back to Cherry Hill or Broomall after the viewing ends. A scene like this reminds me how much the city has changed. The parents of those around me used to control City Hall, but those days are over. They don't have the votes anymore, and they haven't since the late 70s, but they're together tonight to mourn the passing of the mother of two public figures. It's a matter of respect, the sort of thing we could use more of these days. I wasn't sure whether I'd come. The kids are going back to school soon, and it would have been a nice night to grill. I didn't know the decedent, but I'm glad I'm here. I'm always glad when I get here. I've never regretted paying respects, but I've often been sorry when I didn't. It's dark outside an hour and 20 minutes later, but I've rounded the corner at South 3rd Street. Near Garrett, a big-screen TV flickers through a picture window that sports a star for somebody serving overseas. People are still arriving. The line is even longer than when I first joined it, but it's time to turn off the BlackBerry and go inside. A well-respected woman has passed, and so has an era. I referenced this column when signing off from the Daily News in 2011. I wrote, quote, "Of all that I've written in nearly a decade at the Daily News, I'm most proud of Requiem for an Era. In it, I tried to capture how the city had changed in the last few decades based on observations I jotted down while standing in a viewing line as it snaked along a South Philly street. I wrote the entire column on my BlackBerry using my thumbs. I never said whose funeral it was because I thought it would distract from my observations, but I was paying my respects to John Dougherty after the passing of his mother, Mary Teresa, so I'm closing that loop now, unquote. McCain fails the Big Five tests. Philadelphia Inquirer, October 19, 2008. I've decided. My conclusion comes after reading the candidates' memoirs and campaign platforms, attending both party conventions, interviewing both men multiple times, and watching all primary and general election debates. John McCain is an honorable man who has served his country well, but he will not get my vote. For the first time since registering as a Republican 28 years ago, I'm voting for a Democrat for president. I may have been an appointee in the George H.W. Bush administration and master of ceremonies for George W. Bush in 2004, but last Saturday I stood amid the crowd at an Obama event in North Philadelphia. Five considerations have moved me: terrorism, the economy, the vice president, opportunity, and hope. Terrorism. The candidates disagree as to where to prosecute the war against Islamic fundamentalists. Barack Obama is correct in saying the front line in that battle is not Iraq, it's the Afghan-Pakistan border. Osama bin Laden crossed that border from Tora Bora in December of 2001, and we stopped pursuit. The Bush administration outsourced the hunt for bin Laden and instead invaded Iraq. No one in Iraq caused the death of 3,000 Americans on 9/11. Our invasion was based on a false predicate, so we have no business being there, regardless of whether the surge is working. Our focus must be the tribal-ruled Fatah region in Pakistan. Only recently has our military engaged al-Qaeda there in operations that mirror those Obama was ridiculed for recommending in August of 2007. Last spring, Obama told me, quote, "It's not that I was opposed to war in Iraq. It's that I felt we had a war that we had not finished," unquote. Even Senator Joe Lieberman conceded to me last Friday that, quote, "the headquarters of our opposition, our enemies today," unquote, is the Fatah. Economy. We face economic problems that are incomprehensible to most Americans. Certainly they are to me. This is a time to covet intellect, and that begins at the top. Jack Bogle, the legendary founder of the Vanguard Group, told me recently that McCain's assertion that the fundamentals of the economy were quote-unquote strong was, quote, "the stupidest statement of 2008, unquote. In light of the unprecedented volatility in the market, who can dispute Bogle's characterization and the lack of understanding that McCain's assessment portends? VP. I opined here that Sarah Palin demonstrated the capacity to be president in her speech to the Republican convention. Sadly, there has been no further exhibition of her abilities, and she remains an unknown quantity. We are left questioning the judgment of a candidate who bypassed his reported preferred choices, Lieberman and former Governor Tom Ridge, and instead yielded to the whims of the periphery of his party. With two wars and a crumbling economy, Palin is too big of a risk to be a heartbeat away from a presidency held by a 72-year-old man who has battled melanoma. Advantage, Joe Biden. Opportunity. In a speech delivered on Father's Day, Obama lamented that too many fathers are missing from the lives of too many children and mothers. Look no further than Philadelphia for proof that the nation has a fatherhood problem at the root of its firearms crisis. And no demographic is affected by this confluence of factors like the black community. Among the many elements needed to address this crisis are role models, individuals whom urban youth can aspire to emulate. Little more than a year ago, Charles Barkley told me, quote, "I want young black kids to see Barack on television every day. We need to see more blacks who are intelligent, articulate, and who carry themselves with great dignity," unquote. Obama can be that man. Hope. Wednesday morning will come, and an Obama presidency holds the greatest chance for unifying us here at home and restoring our prestige around the globe. The campaigns have foretold the kind of presidency we can expect from each candidate. Last Friday in Lakeville, Minnesota, McCain himself had to explain to a supporter who was quote-unquote scared of an Obama presidency that those fears were unfounded. Another told McCain that Obama was untrustworthy because he is an quote-unquote Arab. Those exchanges were a predictable byproduct of ads against Obama featuring taglines such as too risky for America and quote-unquote dangerous, and a failure to rein in individuals at McCain events who highlighted Obama's middle name, all against a background of internet lore. Last Saturday at Progress Plaza, I heard Obama say, quote, "The American people aren't looking for somebody to divide this country. The American people are looking for someone to lead this country," unquote. This was one of the more consequential columns I have written. I deliberated about whether to be public about my election choice and had the option of remaining mum. But where I'd been increasingly uncomfortable with the direction of the Republican Party over time, I felt I owed it to my audience to explain what I was doing and why. Perhaps what is most significant is that I didn't feel I could fully explain myself in 850 words, which is what my Inquirer columns were then running. So I wrote a 5,625-word essay for Salon.com that ran on September 11, 2008 under the headline, "Why This Lifelong Republican May Vote for Obama." The column focused solely on the issue of hunting down bin Laden and which presidential candidate was willing to do that which it took to capture him. You can still check it out at Salon.com. Their Stanley Cup runneth over. Philadelphia Daily News, November 20, 2008. Street hockey was once the stickball of suburbia. In the Philly suburbs in the early 1970s, it was an after-school sport that lots of kids played. The Flyers were the rage, and we each had orange and black jerseys emblazoned with our favorite players' names and numbers. We'd imitate Bernie Perron and Bobby Clark, and every class bully became the team's Dave Schultz. A guy in my neighborhood took metal from a swing set and made two goals using sewn-together burlap bags for netting. Goalies had foam rubber pads. It was teenage bliss. Long before organized soccer, kids would face off in parking lots, on tennis courts, and anywhere there was a lip around a flat surface to stop an errant Mylick ball. Each neighborhood and subdivision had its own loosely affiliated team, and pickup games were easily hatched without any formal league and were free of adult oversight. I once played at the Burpee Playground, named for the local family of vegetable seed fame. It had a fenced-in basketball court, making it the ideal rink. The team from the Burpee neighborhood had a guy named Joel Gingras. He was a quote-unquote ringer, who played ice hockey at the Face-Off Circle in Warminster and in college for St. Bonaventure. Unfortunately, Joel died in 1988 of a brain tumor at 27. The next year, family and friends established the Joel Anthony Gingras Jr. Memorial Fund to increase awareness of brain tumor research and raise money to help combat this deadly affliction. In 20 years, the JAG Fund has given more than $806,000 to the American Brain Tumor Association. It's a silver lining to a sad story, and it's just gotten better. Enter Bill Clement. Clement is, of course, the former Philadelphia Flyer and now a Versus and NBC broadcaster. It's his voice you hear on EA Sports NHL 2009. Clement lives in Bucks County, not too far from where Joel Gingras grew up. He's one of the guys whose jerseys we wore playing street hockey when he was a member of both Flyers' Stanley Cup teams in 1973-74 and 1974-75. Today, the NHL has a grand tradition of entrusting the Stanley Cup to each member of the championship team for 24 hours, but that tradition didn't start until after the Flyers won their back-to-back championships. A couple of years ago, Clement started thinking about trying to bring the Stanley Cup to Bucks County. When the NHL and Hockey Hall of Fame graciously agreed, he began organizing a charity fundraiser. 4 years ago, Clement heard of the JAG Fund from a co-worker at ESPN named Jay Altmaier, a college classmate of Joel Gingras. Clement decided that the visit by the Cup would benefit the JAG Fund and NOVA, which aids crime victims in Bucks County. Quote, "When I knew I was getting the Cup for a day, the first person I called was Jonathan Gingras, one of Joel's brothers," Clement told me. "I am close to NOVA, and the two charities seemed like naturals. I wanted to keep the money local because of my affinity for Bucks County, where I have lived for 20 years, unquote. The visit was scheduled for last Saturday. On Friday, when flights from Toronto to Philadelphia were canceled due to weather, the event was in jeopardy. Within a half hour of learning of the transportation dilemma, Altmaier called a buddy in Canada named Joe DePlantis, who works as a PGA caddy, and in no time, he and a friend were in a car with the Cup and its minder, Mike Bolt, headed for Bucks County. They arrived at Clement's house at 4:15 a.m. Game on. Later that day, at the Middle Bucks Institute of Technology, a few thousand dads and sons were happy to pay a buck or two to see the Cup. By mid-afternoon, police were directing traffic away from the school. The crowd of several thousand was already so large that they couldn't fit any more people in. Clement said it was one of the best days of his life and that the event raised more than $55,000. Quote, "Some people might not believe this, but Saturday for me was better than winning the Cup," unquote, he said. Jonathan Gingras's take? Quote, "I truly believe that Joel had something to do with this weekend's success," unquote. What I didn't report in the column is that Bill Clement's display of the Stanley Cup for charity was so successful that on the day of the event, I drove with my three sons but couldn't get near the school where it was held. There were too many people. Bill had no way of knowing that, and prior to the event, had mentioned to me that he'd be hosting friends at his home that night for a private viewing of the Cup. It was an awfully nice invitation, but I had no intention of taking him up on it, as I suspected it was for his closer friends and wanted to respect his private time with the Cup for the short time it would be in his possession. But after dinner that night, with the boys' afternoon disappointment lingering in my mind, I felt differently and decided to accept the invitation after all. With my wife and three sons in our car, I found what I thought was the Clement residence outside of New Hope, Bucks County, and drove down the driveway. There were a few cars outside, but not so many that we knew definitively that there was a party going on inside. It was a chilly night, and I remember leaving the car running with my wife and sons in it while I scouted the situation. I walked up onto a porch and peered inside the house. Lo and behold, I was looking into Bill Clement's kitchen, and sitting on the counter was the Stanley Cup. I ran back to the car and excitedly told my gang. The boys scrambled out of the car. My wife thought we were interlopers and the whole thing a bit ridiculous and didn't join us. We went inside, and within minutes, Bill had us drinking champagne from the Stanley Cup. My dinner with Pervez. Philadelphia Daily News, January 27, 2009. On Sunday, I had dinner with ex-Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf in town for a talk at the World Affairs Council, courtesy of Raza and Sabina Bukhari. Raza is a past president of the Pakistani-American Public Affairs Committee. I've written many times on my frustration with U.S. policy on Pakistan. We've outsourced the hunt for Osama to Pakistan, which lacks the will and motivation to get the job done. I voted for Obama in part because on this issue, he promised change. I was seated at Musharraf's right and across from Senator Arlen Specter, who explained to Musharraf my media role, including my radio show. Musharraf told me he wasn't doing interviews. He'd had a contentious interview with CNN's Wolf Blitzer, but had no intention of doing any more. So I didn't use my recorder or take notes, but Musharraf gave me permission to ask whatever I wanted. I said that many of us wanted to know how the Pakistani government could reach an accord with the leaders of the tribal region in the fall of 2006, about the time it was revealed that the U.S. was sending $80 million a month to Pakistan to fight al-Qaeda. Musharraf spoke decent English in a low but audible voice. He didn't look at me, but interrupted his meal and stared straight ahead while speaking. It was a conversation only between the two of us. Defiant is probably the best description of his tone. He said many Americans were naive. People don't understand Pakistan, he said. There are Pakistani troops in those tribal areas, overlooking my point that they weren't doing anything, and 1,500 Pakistani soldiers had died in the war on terror. There are important matters of strategy, he said, and, quote, don't tell us what to do in our country, unquote. I wanted to know what we had to show for the $11 billion the U.S. had paid the Pakistani government for its counterterror efforts. He said this was very, quote-unquote, frustrating, that there had been many successes by the Pakistanis in the war against terror and that many leaders of al-Qaeda had been killed. He lamented that in his own country, he is perceived as a U.S., quote-unquote, lackey, and in the U.S., he is seen as, quote-unquote, double-dealing. Incidentally, the buzz in the room is that he's not well off. More than one individual surmised over cocktails that for all the money that was paid to Pakistan, you'd think Musharraf wouldn't need to do the U.S. lecture circuit, which is the reason for this visit. I told him of my trip to Qatar and how I had visited CENTCOM headquarters and seen the maps depicting military activity in real time, including how all U.S. troop activity stopped at Pakistan. I told him that soldiers told me of frustration at not being able to pursue al-Qaeda when it retreats into Pakistan. He said that wasn't true. Soldiers had crossed the border, but it's foolish for them to do so. Because of the terrain and the nature of life in the tribal areas, they could get sucked in and killed in great numbers. According to Musharraf, crossing from the Afghanistan border was not an option for American troops. He also said that terrorism was created in Afghanistan and imported to Pakistan, not vice versa. With some reluctance, because I was sure he'd heard it 1,000 times, I asked where bin Laden was. In the Swat Valley? He laughed and said no. In Waziristan? More grimly, he said, quote-unquote, I don't know. I asked what he thought when Barack Obama said in August of 2007 that if Musharraf didn't act on intelligence regarding high-level al-Qaeda targets, the U.S. would. Musharraf said they are doing that. He said, we mix up strategy and tactics. Tactics, he said, are how to deal with al-Qaeda. There is disagreement there, he said, but overall, strategically, we agree. I expected him to say that Obama was wrong to make that assertion. He did not, but did offer that personality changes don't change policy. Only changes in policy do. He said that the aims he had pursued with President Bush was the best policy. He also said that through last March, things in his country were quote-unquote pretty good, which I found to be odd. He left office in August. I asked if Pakistani condemnation of U.S. predator strikes are simply to save face. Musharraf took this as an opportunity to tell me how angry Pakistani people are with the Americans. He said the man on the street doesn't like the U.S., but the U.S. needs Pakistan and vice versa. When I asked what we Americans don't understand about the situation in Pakistan, he said that the Mumbai coverage had been all about the Pakistani role, with very little said of the Indian role. He said that Americans don't appreciate the danger posed by India, which had sided with the Soviets during the Cold War, and that for more than 40 years, we'd been allies of the Pakistanis, and people were too quick to question Pakistan's loyalty to the U.S. He repeatedly made a case for continued U.S. economic aid to Pakistan. By then, others had taken their places at the table. I felt I was monopolizing the conversation. Switching to a lighter topic, I asked him how he relaxed. He mentioned reading and tennis, describing himself as a good defensive player. He also sang the praises of bridge. So what were my other impressions? He was most anxious to defend his policies. From my first words, he was very forceful, measured, never ungentlemanly, but very determined. And in the bigger picture, as our limited foreign policy attention focuses on Gaza, Iraq, and Afghanistan, real American security is being determined in Pakistan, where the same forces who killed 3,000 7 years ago continue to have free rein. This column was one of nearly a dozen that I wrote expressing disenchantment with the way the Bush administration was pursuing Osama bin Laden by placing too much responsibility in President Musharraf's hands. I said likewise on radio and television. It still stuns me to think about my friend Raza calling and saying, "Why not come to dinner with him?" 2 days later, after I gave a recap on radio, which Raza heard, he called me and said the president had enjoyed our dialogue and had consented to a formal interview with me. 1 day later, I returned to Raza's house where, in his wine cellar, I recorded a lengthy discussion with Musharraf. On the record, I did my best to summarize how I saw the situation –